By Lisa Thiel, one of the artists that we highlight here on the show. Well, tonight it is my great pleasure to bring you the professor of women, gender, and sexuality studies at Florida Atlantic University. Her name is Jane Caputi. She's the author of several books, all of which you will no doubt want to go out and buy. They are the first one, The Age of Sex Crimes, the second one, Gossips, Gorgons, and Crones, The Fates of the Earth, and three, Goddesses and Monsters, Women, Myth, Power, and Popular Culture. She also collaborated on Webster's first new intergalactic wikidary of the English language with Mary Daly. I don't know when she does this, probably between 2 and 3 a.m. She also found the time to make a short documentary film called The Pornography of Everyday Life, and she's now working on a new film, Green Consciousness, Reattachment to Mother Earth. What a body of work. And I have to tell you, listeners, I get a lot of books from folks who come on the show, but I cannot wait to devour these two books of Jane's. We're going to get into how she sees, popular culture taking away the sacredness of the female. And she uses examples of a lot of movies out there that I'm sure you will never, ever look at the same way again. She really just, has us analyze these movies and see things in these movies we've never seen before. It would be great fun to gather your friends together, rent these movies on Netflix or something with Jane's books in hand and see what she's talking about. But you'll see what I mean as we start to chat later on. So stay tuned. Call in if you like, if you're listening live, you can call in after we get started at 718-766-4662, because this is a really interesting subject, and I know most of you listen from the archives, however, but I will, if I see your phone number pop up on the switchboard, I'll get to you when we have a natural break in the conversation. But before Jane and I start our chat, as usual, just a few quick announcements. And a little bit of a statement I want to make. I want to remind folks here in Southern California, in the L.A. area, particularly if you're close to Hollywood, save the dates. Save the fourth Sunday of every month, because Sacred Sundays are back at the Green Man in Hollywood. Our first service, this coming week, this Sunday will be our second service after being on hiatus for, I could hardly believe it was 3 years. But we're back and we're doing them again. And from the feedback from those who came, to the service last month, they enjoyed it. It rocked. So please come and see us. It's a very eclectic service honoring the divine feminine and the sacred masculine. They're singing and sharing and wisdom telling. In fact, I'll probably talk about these books. A great way to connect with the community and carve out some sacred space for yourself once a month. You can learn more about them from my webpage, KarenTate.com. All you do is go to the Sacred Sundays button, click on it, and you can see what it's all about. And I am one of the Sacred Sunday Sacred Feminine facilitators, so come out and say hello. I also want to tell you about the occupation of Washington that's starting October 6th. It's called Stop the Machine, Create a New World. You can find out more about it if you go to October2011.org. But here's the call to action, and I just want you to hear it. In Freedom Plaza, Washington, D.C., starting October 6, 2011, join the October 2011 coalition, groups who advocate for peace and social, economic, and environmental justice, and a sustained occupation and nonviolent resistance to stop the machine, create a new world. What is the machine? Corporatism and militarism. What new world is possible? One in which people's needs are more important than corporate profits, in which we unite our struggles for jobs, education, housing, health care, and human rights, in which we are free to implement solutions for a peaceful, just, and sustainable world. So please visit October2011.org, learn more about it, and take the pledge. Spread the word. History is knocking. Will you be there? I'm actually planning to go to this. I have been waiting for this for a long time, and I'm going to be there, and I'm going to see the Smithsonian, too, while I'm there. Pose this question, can we stop the Super Congress? Here's hoping someone in authority actually files suit or takes some action to stop the Super Congress proposed by Obama and the Republicans in the debt ceiling bill. That super committee is giving a dozen congressmen all the power and control, and that subverts our democracy and constitution. If you don't know about this, take some time, read up on it. The super congress might very well be a violation of our constitution and the system of checks and balances, which is designed to keep legislation from not being passed without sufficient consensus. It's very dangerous and slippery slope. No dozen people should have our lives in their hands. That's far too small a body that can too easily be corrupted. And how many of us believe the Democrats will even stand their ground and protect Social Security and Medicare when faced eyeball to eyeball with Tea Party thugs who will never compromise on anything? So get angry, get activated, get organized, stop the Super Congress, the Tea Party, and the Republican machine. You know, listeners, these people are the antithesis of the sacred feminine ideals, which are negotiation and partnership, balance and justice. These are corporate pawns who want to privatize the country and destroy our social safety net. They've already shown they care nothing for working class people. Can I be any clearer? It's up to every one of us to stop them. So I hope to see you in Washington. I hope you're signing petitions. I hope you're showing up at local protests. Google the Super Congress. Go to October2011.org. And if you stay with me after my interview with Jane, I'll share with you something funny and light called The Evolution of the GOP, which will no doubt have you smiling and shaking your head in agreement. One of my listeners, also named Jane, sent it in to me yesterday, so thanks, Jane. So don't go away after the interview. But that brings tonight's announcements and comments to a close as we get to tonight's guest, Jane Caputi. Let me read her bio to you. I've already done that, those wonderful books. Forgive me for that. I'm just going to say hello to Jane. I think she's probably back with me.
Hi,
Jane.
Yep.
Thank you so much for being on the show. Well, I don't know if you heard me tell listeners at the top that I can't wait to read these books. And
yes,
already
I did. Thank you.
Already suggested to them that they go get them and go out to Netflix and, you know, have some fun with their friends, you know, renting the movies with your book in hand, and they'll never see these movies the same again. Why don't we just start at the top with, how you connect, popular culture. You see popular culture, as how the female sacredness has sort of been stripped from our psyches and from our culture. I don't know if I said that right. Maybe you could do better.
No, you said it just fine. I mean, because popular culture is really ambivalent. It does both those things. In some way, it provides a conduit to the sacred feminine, at least some aspects of it. And in other ways, it really seeks to obliterate it. We all know that it's filled with hideous projections, horrible, hate-filled stereotypes and stories about female victimization and serial killers and all that kind of stuff. And all that's true. That's really a part of our popular culture. But I remember as a child, I mean, I was brought up in this very Catholic, New York, Italian, Irish, Catholic home, Catholic school all my life, and I knew that wasn't for me. But I would watch these movies. I don't know if any of you have ever seen these. I grew up in the 50s. Cat Women of the Moon.
Oh, yeah.
The Mermaids of Tiburon. And there were all these movies about these all-female societies or this world where all the women and the men worship the goddess. And, of course, the whole story was that, of course, you know, these societies had to be overturned. They were backwards, etc. But it still fed my imagination, my little young imagination, that there really was an alternative way, and that the world always wasn't this way, with men being in charge of everything and lording it over women and all this completely straight society, etc. It really opened me up, and it gave me a rich source of fantasy and imagination. And remember,
little did they know where that was going to go.
Yeah,
well,
I think they did know. Yeah, they didn't know exactly where it was. But, I mean, there used to be this ad for the X-Files that showed this big X. And we know X is the mystery. X is the female chromosome. X is all kinds of things. And it said, nothing disappears without a trace. And even though patriarchy has, for 5,000 to 7,000 years, been trying to discredit our history, obliterate our knowledge, they can't do it. It doesn't disappear. They can't disappear it or us completely. We often go underground and surface in another way. So elements of, you know, those ancient and still evolving and to come ways of knowledge and being that recognize the sacred feminine often are expressed metaphorically or narratively or a bit sideways through popular culture. I see it, for example, in like the green beings in Shrek and Princess Fiona. I could go on and on.
Well,
but,
you know, some of the ones that jumped out at me when I skimmed because was Jaws. You talk about the
Jaws.
Great white shark in Jaws. You say, though deceptively called he, actually represents the primordial female in her most dreaded aspects. Tell us about that.
Yes. It's funny. I'm sure you and some of your listeners are familiar with Mary Daly. I mean, I was an undergraduate at Boston College, and I had graduated in 1974. But Mary Daly, you know, I went on to work with her, and I was working with her in 1975 when Jaws came out, too. And we went to see that movie together. And she was writing gynecology at the time. I was doing a lot of the research for her, and I had gone and started to look up all these kinds of world creation myths and myths of female power. So that was all very fresh in my mind. And seeing Jaws, you know, I recognized immediately that this figure is the vagina dentata. This figure is the all-powerful womb, the source of both birth, life, and death.
Well,
and
you know,
this
you're
is the figure.
Me of.
Go ahead, yeah.
Well, you know, you're reminding me of in Maori culture, there's a myth about the female goddess having teeth in her vagina.
Yeah, it's all over the world, all over the world. And in some ways, you know, patriarchy has, of course, taken this myth and turned it into something that she was a monster and a hero had to knock out her teeth so that men could have intercourse with women and the world could begin. But it really is not about the beginning of the world. It's about the beginning of patriarchy knocking out the teeth. Even now, do some of you have dreams sometimes where you're missing a tooth or a tooth falls out? I mean, teeth are real symbols of power. And the Gorgon Medusa had fangs, the serpent, and we all know the importance of the serpent to goddess religion and mythology, has those fangs. You know, the mouth, the oral mouth, the mouth on our face, the mouth of the womb. The teeth represent that kind of power. And if you think about Jaws, the first victim, you know, I mean, I could. There's a whole complex analysis here, but that the sea, anytime you have myths of the primordial deep, you're talking about the sacred feminine, always
okay.
The ocean. Even the word la mer, right, in French, that's where we get the word Mary, marine.
Okay.
You know, it's all very much related. So Jaws really, and it came out in 1975, right when Roe v. Wade had become law of the land.
Okay.
And suddenly it's all this male fear about, oh, dismemberment of male bodies in the ocean, all these little boys in danger, et cetera. But it really is the return of the repressed. It's the return, and she's raging. You know, this was the symbol of the feminist movement as well.
Wow.
Raging female power in Jaws. And even though they kill the shark, we know that shark is immortal. We know that shark really, in some ways, is us.
Well, you know, this might be a dumb question, but do you think on some primal level, you know, when men have intercourse with women, they feel like they're being devoured? I mean,
yeah.
Is that okay?
I do, and I think that's probably why they patriarchal men construct that kind of, you know, they make heterosexuality the only possible sexuality, and then they construct heterosexuality along lines of, like, the woman is supposed to lie completely still underneath and the man pounds on her, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which,
mm-hmm.
as we all know, not only is erotically awful, right?
Right.
But it's a ritual seemingly based in fear and desire to dominate and
right.
to reject any notion that one might be being engulfed, right?
Right,
but,
exactly.
And yeah. So I do. I think it's very, very connected. I think sexuality and powerful female sexuality is so central to female sacredness, right? And that, go ahead.
Well, I wanted you to finish your thought, and then I was gonna move on to another movie and ask you about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but just that you know, it is so important that our sexuality is turned either into, it's turned into obscenity mostly in pornography. I mean, the goddess religion with the powerful naked goddess with the understanding
mm-hmm.
of that power of life, death, regeneration, which is the power not only of birth and reproduction, but the power of conception and the thought of conception as also thinking and ideas, right? It is
mm-hmm.
the essential life force. That is completely turned into pornography. All that was sacred has been rendered obscene in patriarchy.
Well, imagine if they hadn't done that. I mean, you know, just playing devil's advocate here, and I'm certainly not their advocate, but imagine if we had been able to let the sacred feminine retain her sacredness and women's bodies retain their sacredness. I mean, maybe it's hard for some women to even imagine how we've been damaged, but imagine how different things would be.
How different indeed,
you know, when because if you take the sacredness out of the equation, well, then, you know, they can just, you know, do anything, can't they?
They can. That's really what, you know, people often ask me, what do I mean by pornography? I certainly don't mean sexual representations or things
mm-hmm.
that arouse us. I would be completely in favor of that. Pornography is like what takes the being or the spirit out of it. To render it into an object, something that can be used as a resource, exploited, or
mm-hmm.
channeled outside
right.
of, you know, taking away the autonomy of the one who's generating that energy and letting that sexual energy be exploited and put into things like militarism, corporate consumption, et cetera.
Right.
Right,
well,
you know.
It's almost as if, you know, the woman's vagina is just a commodity, a body part. It's not like it's even attached to a human feeling person, you know.
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's another movie that I saw that I really loved, and I had forgotten about this until I read it here. It was The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
And
you put her under the virgin cannibal category. Did you want to talk about that one a little bit? Because I found
that one
really
interesting. That one, you know, obviously that one offers a lot in terms of gay and trans liberation. But in some ways, it still was trading in really bad sexist stereotypes. And again, we have, like, the emblem of female power, who's this Asian woman. So we get,
mm-hmm.
like, some kind of racism in there, and that she's really presented speaking this sort of choppy language, and she's, like, an archetypal sort of dragon lady ball buster.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember this, because this was from some time ago, I include this in an article I wrote with Lori Sagal about the way that women of color, basically, if I can backtrack one second, goddess
sure.
is not only turned into pornography, goddess is turned into monster, right?
Okay.
Some kind of monster. So this article is about, particularly about the stereotypes by which women of color are rendered monstrous. So yes, we make her the sort of virgin cannibal there. And there's this scene where she's doing a strip tease, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I remember this correctly.
Yeah, with the ping pong balls.
Yes, and like she puts a ping pong ball in her vagina and spits it out and everything. So we get this image of this sort of voracious vagina dentata sort of cannibal man-eater.
Mm-hmm.
And again, all of these are sort of distortions of what actually I would call concupiscence. It's an ancient word that means all-powerful, and some linguists relate it to the C-U-N-T word, although it isn't strictly linguistically. I hope I can spell that out on the radio. Was that okay?
Yeah, I think that was probably fine.
Oh, dear. Sorry.
No, that's okay. No, I do think it was fine.
I think as long as you don't, yeah. But a concupiscence is actually means all-powerful, but not in the sense of all-powerful, meaning I can completely dominate you, but in the sense of feeling the interconnecting power of the all. But we're not really given. We're these kinds of powers, women's bodies, women's sexuality, are presented in these distorted ways. So, the power is made into something as a caricature, something threatening, something demonic, something monstrous that needs to be either mocked, contained, or even destroyed.
Well, and you go on and talking about women of color and indigenous women, you were talking about the difference between like the Virgin and Bloody Mary, you know, and how the movies tend to treat, the indigenous Virgin versus the indigenous Bloody Mary, you know, and it all comes down to men's fear, doesn't it?
Doesn't it, though? Yeah, I know. It does come down to men's fear. And, there's all kinds of psychoanalysis saying how men have to separate from the feminine, which also includes not only the literal mother, but the Mother Earth, right?
Mm-hmm.
In order to maintain masculinity, that if you're in any kind of connective or respectful relationship with femininity, the way we construct masculinity is that masculinity will be sucked, devoured, will be destroyed or assimilated by the feminine. So in order to maintain the separation necessary to keep masculinity as patriarchy defines it, you have to, again, mock, separate from, or even destroy the feminine. You know, have power over.
But why is that, Jane? I mean, is it possible to know, why it first started that men had to be afraid or decided they were going to be afraid of the sacred feminine? Do you think it was maybe, they were afraid of their lust or, their loss of control?
Yeah,
they
were afraid. I mean, a lot of people, afraid of their loss of control, afraid that women's sexuality was more powerful than they. I'm not really sure, really, because I don't think there was any fear until there was some kind of division, which was brought about for whatever reasons, like it was a mistake maybe some long time ago, where you started getting this belief in this separate kind of gender division in which men were qualitatively different than women. Once you started to do that, and you started getting an exploitation of oppression and fear, pretty much everybody, if you oppress somebody, they're afraid of who they oppress because they know that there's going to be a reprisal, right? There's
mm-hmm,
going to be some
mm-hmm.
kind of revolt. But also, your identity is insecure because it's a
right.
fake identity to begin with, right? This
right,
complete
right.
separation, this idea that men are totally different from women, which is, again, women can wear pants, and it doesn't threaten that many people. But, like, if a man puts a skirt on, right?
Yeah.
It's much more important in patriarchal rules that men be considered, like, this separate. This, anything, the worst way to put down a man is to call him a girl, right? And various obscene. So any taint, femininity is seen as a taint. So, of course, you're going to be afraid of women.
And that makes me, can we connect this to this outrageous fear that we see from the religious right with their homophobia?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, misogyny and homophobia are very greatly linked because, the way that misogynists and often religious homophobes see male homosexuality is that one man has to play the role of the woman, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing more atrocious and shameful to them, right?
Right.
And so, I think that is, and it's also these men are not doing their job in keeping up this image of the straight, hard, separate, contained masculinity
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
is associated with heterosexual culture.
Right. Well, of course we don't know, but just going back to the beginning, whenever this, if you want to call it separation, started, it's
splitting.
The splitting, why did they go fearful of the woman and have to demonize her rather than just enjoy her, and take what she had to offer and revel in it? It's really interesting, why they went the fear route and not the, enjoy the lust or whatever it was.
Yeah, right.
there
was another pleasure that they sought, which was the pleasure of absolute power.
Maybe
so. And ego.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and if,
we can be prey to that, too. Any human being could be, right?
But, well, and if you're, and I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it just hit me that if you are getting this pleasure from this woman, then she is the one in control, isn't she?
Well, that could be the way they interpret it, but it also could be seen as completely mutual.
Yeah.
But, you know,
yeah.
you do have to be willing to give up control. You do have to be willing to give up control. But the model that patriarchy seems bent on is a model of absolute control, absolute. I mean, that's their god, right?
Mm-hmm.
Completely
well, let's get in.
Separate, in control, domineering, yeah, untouchable, immutable.
Yeah, that
hard,
authoritarian
hard.
Father.
The
well,
omnipotent.
Well, let's get into that. So how does patriarchal religion, I mean, I know a lot of us know these answers, but I do have listeners that are new to this stuff. You know, how does patriarchal religion contribute, to the disrespect for women and the violence against the earth? I mean, because it's all wrapped up in there. I mean, woman, earth, the other species of the planet. I mean, we're all the ones that are being oppressed by patriarchal religion and
mm-hmm.
patriarchy.
Yeah, we're all sort of lumped together as like the dirty, the inferior, the closer to matter than to spirit, closer to nature than to culture. You know, this hierarchy is set up. But
and we're less than, of course, on that ladder.
Excuse me?
We're less than. We're less than mm-hmm. on that ladder, yeah.
We are indeed. You know, what patriarchal religion does is, first of all, you know, well, in the biblical tradition, humans are cast out of the garden. We're said to be and told to dominate the earth, right? You know? I mean,
mm-hmm.
humans will dominate the earth and the man will dominate the woman, and it's told to her, you know, and he'll lord it over you and you'll love it, you know? So
mm-hmm.
it's almost like a biblical injunction to S&M in some ways, right? It is.
Yeah.
But which is why, you know, that it really is the hidden norm. But,
and you show in your books a lot of ads where if you
mm-hmm.
really look at it with these thoughts in mind, you can see where even in advertisements, the woman is subjugated. You know, she's the submissive one. You know,
and making it, but then her pleasure is welded to her submission.
Mm-hmm.
Over and over and over, and man's pleasure is welded to his domination over and over and over and over.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are like prayers, right? They're like people used to learn from going into the ancient, you know, the medieval cathedrals and seeing, even if they were illiterate, all the stained glass windows and all the kinds of images being portrayed. And we still are being instructed daily with our visual culture. We're taking in all these messages, and they have very consistent and repeated messages. For example, the one that we've just described. And that's just going into us unconsciously all the time. And it really becomes the norm. It becomes reality. And, you know, our sense of ourselves, as well as our sense of eroticism, is welded to these power relations. And that's why sometimes it's so hard to resist. Because, you know, these very intimate parts of your being have really been conditioned
mm-hmm.
to go along with this, too. This power structure.
And if you sort of resist the indoctrination, well, if you're in a patriarchal religion, well, you maybe think there must be something wrong with you.
Yeah, you often think, am I mad? You know, am I?
Or am I a sinner?
Or am I, we have the sinner or the crazy woman, right? Those are our options.
Or the whore.
And in the meantime, you know, we go back to like how the earth, but like what patriarchal religion does with God is something really different. Suddenly, God, and there's not really, you know, they've said that there is just one God, he's male, and he's away from the earth. Actually, he dominates the earth. He's in heaven. And earth is the source of hell, right?
Mm-hmm.
As well as tribulation and all of that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we get this really huge jump where the earth used to be the divine force, the mother, right?
Right.
And now suddenly the earth is said not only is sort of inert matter, spirit is separated from matter. And that is what not only patriarchal religion, but sort of abstract rationality that is characteristic of patriarchal philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a huge thing. Suddenly matter is dispirited. Mm-hmm. And that means you can do anything you want to it.
Right.
And you think it doesn't, quote unquote, matter. You also think because it's not alive and it's not connected to you that you could do anything you want to it and it's not going to affect you. And that's really the lie, right? Because
right.
anything yeah. we do to the other, we really also do to ourselves. But we've lost that sense of the overall interconnectedness of life, which is part of, as you were saying, feminine sacrality, which is that negotiation, which is that ending of hierarchy, which is that seeing how deeply connected we are with all life.
Well, now, you in your other book, The Gossips, Gorgons, and Crones, Fates of
mm-hmm.
the Earth, you say, you know, you offer a different vision of the future, a future that you call, interestingly, you say patriarchal customs will disappear, a new world chaos will emerge.
Mm. Right.
Now, why do you use the word chaos, I wonder? Well, you know, tell us about the vision and why you use the word chaos, because that kind of scares people, I think.
Chaos does. I don't mean like running amok or
okay.
sort of havoc like okay. that can result like in a war zone or something like that. Chaos is certainly something that's emerged in modern scientific thought in
mm-hmm.
which, again, in a strictly rationalist, dualist culture, you have men opposed to women. Up is better than down, right? Like you said, on the ladder, right?
Mm-hmm.
Spirit is better than matter, and you have order is seen as better than chaos. But chaos was always associated with the vagina, really, the yawning abyss, right?
Mm-hmm.
This idea of something that could swallow you up, right?
Or the
so
more like the Big Bang Theory. I mean,
or the big,
would,
yeah.
Yeah.
The black holes in space and the Big Bang, yeah, all of this, right?
But creation comes out of that, too.
That's
so
exactly
it's,
right.
It's a catalyst for creation.
It is. It is. It's the matrix. It's the cosmic womb, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the genitals on both female and male bodies are in their shape and in their powers, represent cosmic forces. I mean, they manifest cosmic forces. And the power of creation, yes, is in that hole, right, that we name chaos or we name the abyss or that we name something scary. It's the monster in Alien. It's the monster in Jaws, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it really is the source of creation. And it's interesting that modern scientific theory has started to recognize that actually there is no pure order. There, you know, this idea of order, of this imposed, like when you fly over the United States and you see all the squares and the grids, right? This idea,
mm-hmm.
that's really for control and ownership. Chaos is like the actual outline of a seashore or the way a tree grows.
Not necessarily a pattern, you mean.
It's not even really, this is difficult. I'm not a physicist, but it's not purely random, but it doesn't have regularly repeated patterns. It grows like according to its own self-organizing logic.
Or like
and
maybe
it's
a
beautiful.
Vine would. Or like a vine
what?
Would grow.
Yes, yes. Or like the chaotic systems are like the steam from a tea kettle or like the witch's cauldron, right, with all that steam rising up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how you know, because it's always going to give you something new that's never existed before.
Okay. And that
so
can
it's
be scary.
Not,
that
can
be
scary, but we got to grow up, don't we?
Right.
So
and
we stop
but
being
also,
scared of this.
So it just really depends on our outlook, doesn't it? It depends on how we react to it. Do we look at it as an adventure or do we go hide under the bed?
Right. Right.
Well, now you, all right, so you say a vision for the future where we don't control nature but align ourselves with the fates, the goals, the purposes of Earth. Talk about that a little bit. What does that look like?
Well, what it looks like, I mean, you mentioned that you had interviewed Vandana Shiva at one point,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think her book, Earth Democracy, is really excellent. I mean, because I'm not as practical, but she really gives some really good ideas about what it would look like. And it often is like what we often see from ecological kind of visions and communities, a lot of local activity, focusing on self-organization, which is a principle of chaos, right, that you don't have order imposed from some authority outside, that within any situation, the group that's coming together knows best how to organize itself and into what shape it will. So I do see, I mean, I think that would be something we need to form ourselves into, we need to gather, and we need to self-organize. And
now, let me ask you a question about that, because does because, you know, we have, forgive me, but, you know, I'm sort of a political activist, and I'm wondering, are you saying something that would appeal to libertarians?
I suppose it could in some ways, except that the idea, but libertarianism is so intensely individualist, right?
Right. And this is more on one another.
Yeah, there has to be a communitarian vision, understanding that human beings need each other, that we have to live within certain boundaries with each other of respect, and that there has to be a balance between individual rights and the rights of the community.
Right.
So,
right.
I from what I understand of libertarianism, it's too radically individualist for me, except when it comes to women's rights.
Yeah, of course. Then there's no rights whatsoever. The uterus, you know, has to listen to the state.
But they won't say it that way. They'll say that it's the fetus's rights that trump the woman's rights.
Yeah,
so they'll
rights
still come into. Yeah, but I think pretty much implicit in most feminist and womanist is a communitarianism, that we have to have collective well-being and the optimization of well-being for all the members of the community, not just the individual. So I do see that.
Okay. So I'm sorry, I interrupted you when you were sort of saying the vision. Was there more to that? So I think you're talking like, like we have these transition towns now. I mean, people are talking about, and people are starting to think about being, you know, working on a more local level, you know, rather than this globalization. And, you know, they're trying to pull things in, I think, closer and have a little bit more interdependence. Not some, you know, because, well, I think they're doing it because they think, well, we're not going to be able to rely on the government, but you're saying from the standpoint of, you know, we should just be more of a community, you know, more, you know, ideals of the sacred feminine, you know, our interconnectedness kind of a thing.
Absolutely. Interconnectedness and collective communal well-being. And probably, you know, this is something that I'm not really that practical, I have to say. So, you know, this is why we need all of us, right? Those who
right.
implement the sort of practical
right.
Aspects of this. But yeah, you know, in some network, right? Networks
yeah.
of these communities and collectivities who, you know, communicate.
Right.
And who, work with each other.
Well, and I mean, and let's face it, you know, if we do have to shift to some new system or structure, it's going to take time. It's not going to, you know, because we've been relying on the one in place for a very long time. And, you know, some of us can't really think out of that box. And for those of us who can, you know, it's not going to be easy to have a new world order, so to speak. I don't know if that's the right terminology.
Well, that's why I was playing on New World Chaos, because
right.
New World Order was pretty much like the old world order of just, you know, the ones on top doing the ordering.
Yeah, the domination.
In all senses of the word. I put you into a category, I establish the order, and then I order you around. And
yeah, and you're probably the cog at the bottom of the wheel, and I'm at the top pulling your string.
Yeah.
Well, all right, so I know we don't have that much more time left because it's late where you are, and I don't want to keep you up too late. So let's get on to some of these other things we were going to talk about. In your first book, The Age of Sex Crimes, well, you argue that serial killers of women are terrorists and as such are made into patriarchal cultural heroes. Tell me about that. Give me some examples.
Well, you know, I wrote this. It was actually my dissertation from 1982. And then, you know, if we think of, I just started looking around, and I actually saw a movie. Do you remember this movie, Time After Time, where it imagines that Jack the Ripper was friends with H.G. Wells and got into his time machine and escaped to San Francisco in 1979 and said, wow, the world has finally caught up with me. I'm home. And I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, I mean, the serial killer is an emblem, I mean, a sort of distillation of patriarchal values at its most basic, of domination and masculinity gendered as domination and destructiveness
and
violence.
Too.
And what Jack the Ripper did was attack. He didn't rape. He this was a still anonymous serial killer from 1888 in London who attacked prostitutes and mutilated their bodies, even stealing the uterus from the bodies of one of the victims. So he mutilated the vulva. And
right.
it just struck me as like a paradigm for the assault of patriarchy on individual women as well as on the earth.
Wow, that's an awesome insight.
Yeah, and we're still doing, I mean, what are all these, there's like a pornographic film called Mr. MX. The MX missile was a nine warhead nuclear missile. I mean, they're still aiming all this. They're still making the penis into the phallus as the ultimate weapon or destruction, whether it's an individual knife or nuclear weapons, and they're still aiming at targets that they identify literally and metaphorically as female.
Wow. And see, if there were only a way to get rid of phallus-shaped items.
Or, you know, I don't want to get rid of the penis. I mean, the penis is wonderful,
no, I know.
Right?
It's some, I know,
no, but you know what I mean? It's
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
no.
The
yeah, but this is
patch.
It. It's sometimes soft, sometimes hard. It's more like a flower. The penis is more like a flower than like a gun, right?
That's true. That's true. When you
yeah.
think about it that way, it really could be that way.
Yeah, but the way our popular culture is always presenting it is as permanently hard and permanently ready to injure, right?
And if it's not, you better take a blue pill.
Yes, and that's a rapist model, and it's the model of the patriarchal God. I grew up in Catholicism, as I said, and the name
mm-hmm.
of God was the omnipotent, meaning constantly potent, constantly hard, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you also think, and you know, and I'm thinking about your analogy of the flower, and I got to tell you, I hadn't thought about that before, but I like that because, you know, that's less, you know, intimidating. You know?
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
and
you
it's
know,
not, it's also true.
Yeah.
Like you said, if they have like a permanent erection, they'd be going to the emergency room, not to, but the phallus is this. Image of the penis as if the penis were in a constant state of erection.
Right. Yeah, and that's the way it's valued in society. And if it's not in that state, well, there's something wrong with it, and you better get it fixed because it
exactly.
needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it needs to be in that that other form. All right, and then you also talk about. You use the terms gynocide or femicide.
Yeah.
And you relate it to the mass murders in the U.S. and Norway. That how does that all connect together? What are those two terms first, and then connected to those shootings?
Right. Well, often, you know, what I mean, femicide is a term that feminists have been using. Diana Russell has been very associated with this term to talk about the sexually political murder of women. So if a woman is working in a convenience store and there's a robbery and she gets killed, that's not necessarily a femicide. It's when a woman is killed deliberately as a woman for reasons of hatred of women, desire to possess and control her, to have a sense of lust murder or pleasure. So femicide is to get us to look at how many of the murders of women that take place, whether it's by men who are in a domestic violence situation, murdering their wives, or if their wives or girlfriends have left them, or these kind of serial killers, you know, all these ways in which women are killed, burned as witches, those are femicides. And gynocide is like a more general term to mean, as akin to genocide, that this is a really, not just about the killing of individual women, but it's this really huge political movement that takes place around the globe, and it's meant to destroy women as a political class.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in order to have feminism, women have to have a sense of collective identity. We have to understand who we are. And gynocide is about destroying women's sense of collective identity, our culture, our language, our traditions, our beliefs. Gynocide is that much larger. And it also entails really the ways in which women are murdered, that it is it's a contemporary form of blood sacrifice, I believe, to the patriarchal God.
Interesting. Well, now, speaking of gynocide and women understanding, you know, our culture, would I be right to make the connection that, say, like the Sarah Palin women, the Michelle Bachmann women, the ones that support the patriarchy, the oppression, are they just totally unaware of all of this? I mean, is that why they seem to be so pro-patriarchy, anti-woman?
Well, let's put a little individualism in there. They get a lot of they're tokens, right? I mean, they both have a lot of energy. You know, I even know some women who completely disagree with them, but like their energy, right? I don't know. I'll leave that up to everybody to decide. But there's always been, you know, one of the ways patriarchy works is to divide women against each other and to reward some women with privilege, right? Which
mm-hmm.
can come, you know, based on their association with powerful men, based on their association with powerful men's ideas and their willingness to promote them. I mean, this is something that has been there right from the beginning, right?
Okay.
So there, I think it's interesting, though, like what's the matter with the Democrats that they have not cultivated powerful women in their own right? I mean, Hillary Clinton
mm-hmm.
certainly is powerful, but she came to prominence because of her husband.
Right.
The Democrats aren't cultivating
no.
powerful women. And the Republicans,
no.
it's very curious that these women have emerged from the Republican side of things. And I think there's a lot of misogyny among leftist and liberal men, too, and fear of female power.
Well, I don't doubt that, but I wondered just to response to what you said, that the right is doing it where the left isn't. I think it's probably only a reaction to Hillary having gone so far.
I think that's a very good point. I think that is true. It is a reaction to Hillary going so far.
Yeah, and they just thought, you know, any vagina would do. Women are so stupid, you know.
Yeah,
and
especially
a
vagina that was in worship of the patriarchal god, you know, and his minions, or his representatives on Earth.
Right, exactly.
I mean, you know, Michelle Bachmann, I'm submissive to my husband. Oh, please, you know.
Well, now, you know, I want to jump down to this item we were going to talk about. Do we need a new religion? What might goddess look like or be like in that religion? And how does God change? I know, I think Mary Daly wrote a little bit about that, but I can't remember enough to speak it. Maybe, how does God change when goddess enters the picture? Does he have to change?
Think so. I don't think you can just still have the patriarchal god and suddenly and give him, you know, some kind of equivalent goddess, right? Because it's
mm-hmm.
not really just about equal representation by sex, right? It's changing the values. You know, you said it very well at the very beginning of the interview that, you know, really the values and the practices associated with the sacred feminine are different.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, the sacred feminine also, you know, encompasses, you know, I mean, we're going to, you know, there's so many different ways. Some people would talk about the sacred masculine. Some would talk about ending gender as we know it, since gender as we know it is an effect of the patriarchal way of splitting and seeing things, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that's an open question right now. But I don't think we would have God. I don't think we would have a God who is, like, abstracted from matter and from the earth
mm-hmm.
and from the feminine. I think we have to have something much more protean. I mean,
we need a Renaissance man who's, like, the archetype for the new God.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
And we need maybe some thinkers on this write the word G-O-D-D. ESS to imply that God and goddess exist in a continuum together.
Yeah, because how many times you see, and I don't know whether this is just an English thing, but even when people talk about the female god, it never has the female ending on the word. You know, they'll just make it sound like it's masculine, you know.
Yeah, I don't
like
that.
Like all the female gods and the male gods are all just God. And I don't know, that seems to take away from the feminine aspect to me.
I agree. It's a pseudo-generic, because people, when they hear God, they're going to think of
male.
A male. But I want to think of powers. I don't know. The word God and even the word goddess in some ways, because of how I know how I hear goddess, and that's very positively, but
mm-hmm.
I don't think everybody hears it that way.
True.
And also, I want to de-anthropomorphize the term so we don't always see a woman or a man,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah, it would be better to see the values, wouldn't it?
Values or all the manifestations of being, be it animal being, plant being, the ocean. You know, I'm sort of, I guess, a pantheist in that way,
mm-hmm.
in that
mm-hmm.
I look to nature a great deal for evocations of the divine. I live near the ocean, so I'm lucky enough to go down and sing Ave Maria, and I mean Ave Maria meaning, you know, the ocean.
The ocean.
Yeah, the mare, right?
Well, I looked at the movie Goddess. Well, I'm curious now, I mean, because your books came out before the movie Avatar. What would you have said if you were still writing a book or a chapter about the movie Avatar?
you know, Avatar is mixed. So many of these movies have, like, these really deeply mixed messages. You know, Avatar, of course, the hero has to be, you know, an earthling, a white man. You know,
that's
yes,
true.
He's in a wheelchair. He's a soldier. But he has to come in and save the day. I mean, we've all kind of seen this, right? And
yeah.
But there is something in there about the sacred tree, about
mm-hmm.
everybody being connected. I mean, Avatar is a little mixed. I personally didn't like the movie.
Mm-hmm.
It just annoyed the hell out of me for some reason. I mean,
really?
Well, I know.
Okay.
But I understand that it also has some good messages going on in there. But you know, he's such a classic hero in that the, you know, the white guy comes in and
yeah.
saves the day for everybody else, all the
other
people.
Saves the helpless indigenous people.
Yeah, who actually saved him, and
sort of just like when the I don't know, I'm sorry, I just got a flash, but as the pilgrims land on our shores, if it wasn't for those indigenous folks, they would have been dead. But then what
right.
do we do? Well, you know, we end up giving them blankets with disease in it, you know, to repay
right.
them for their oh anyway, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just didn't want the movie to be about him centrally. Like, what would if it were like whose point of view is really centered? Matters
mm-hmm.
almost as much as what the story is, because that's who you're told is important. That's whose story it's worth. That's who's it's worth seeing the world through their eyes.
Well, like
you
how
know,
Marion
like
Zimmer Bradley took Mists of Avalon, and she
right.
and she turned it through the eyes of the woman and
of Morgan.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, and I never look at the King Arthur story the same again after reading Mists of Avalon, you know.
Yep, that's it.
Because we all thought Morgan was the bad one, didn't we?
Right. Right, and there's a lot of stories that do that, that suddenly, one is right on the tip of my head right now that is so brilliant in getting us to take the point of view of somebody else, but I'll have to wait a second until it comes to me. But, you know, it's Gloria Anzaldúa, the great poet and essayist and psychic activist. Like, she'd even say, like, about the movie Alien, I identified with the alien. All these soldiers were coming with all these weapons to, like, kill her and her, you know.
Right,
she was
and she was trying to protect her.
Yeah.
You know, this was her
right.
place, her children, her womb and
right.
and babies. Yeah. Oh,
so
God,
it
that
really
reminds
is
me
a strategy sometimes to take the point of view that's subordinated and
right.
tell the story differently.
Right. Well, you know, that reminds me of an old classic Star Trek with William Shatner, where they're in these caves, and this cave monster is coming with them, and at the end they figure out this was just a female trying to protect her young kind of a thing.
Yeah, something like that.
And it totally flips the, you know, what you think the story is going to be about, you know, or who the enemy is.
Absolutely.
You know. So, well, if you think of that movie,
I can't think of it now. It's a movie or a novel that takes a point of view that had previously been ignored or subordinated. But
okay.
Oh well, I'll put it on your Facebook page and
okay. Do we still have a couple minutes? Or
sure,
if
you have.
Okay.
Yeah. Any other?
Well, one of the other things we were going to talk about is what kinds of self-conceptions, new words, symbols, and practices work to make us able to resist domination and imagine and manifest a more just and verdant world. What were you thinking about with that? What did you want to share with us?
I guess I was thinking, well, some of the things we've already talked about, like reconceptualizing sexuality, right, away from these phallic norms and knocking out the idea that only men can be potent. And that
mm-hmm.
there is female potency as well, and that we have names. Like, that's sort of like I made up that, well, I gave it that meaning, cunctipotence.
Mm-hmm.
And that really is a word in the dictionary. But like,
well, what could
we
be
can,
more potent than a woman's womb? You know,
yeah, what could be more potent?
Way. Right.
And, but we don't. We never think of potency with women, and that is, you know, that's part of the problem, right? What else am I thinking?
Or
of?
If we do think of her as potent, we only think of her as a baby maker.
Right,
you know?
Something like that, instead of the kind of, like, you know, instead of that kind of creativity and power, but mm-hmm. power not along lines of domination, but power to bring it all together.
Okay.
Power to face that chaos, right?
Right, exactly. Or create the chaos.
I don't know that we can create the chaos. I think chaos is kind of bigger than us. I think
I'm thinking? I'm thinking about the woman in Egypt who was behind the Egypt Spring. You know?
Which woman?
I don't know her name, but it was in the news about how a woman in her living room was the one who made it all happen. It all sprang
mm-hmm.
from her.
Yes.
And that would be the kind of chaos maybe you're talking
about,
right?
You're absolutely right. I mean, even like the little parable that always it goes with chaos theory is the butterfly. You know, the butterfly
mm-hmm.
flaps her wings in Peking or Beijing, and the weather in New York changes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
that is our strategy. I mean, we are not the women's revolution. The great historian Gerda Lerner says. Will not be an overthrow. It will be a transformation.
Mm-hmm.
And that transformation is taking place every day in small acts, in being in the right place at the right time and having the courage to flap your wings at the right time in the living room in Egypt, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it spreads. And all of us have a part to play in that. It is a completely communal effort in that.
Do you think what we're seeing happening in the Middle East, in Libya, in Wisconsin, do you think we're seeing the paradigm shift before our eyes? I mean, is this what it looks like? Even and also including the crazy extremist stuff on the right. I mean, do you think all of this is part of the transformation, as people see the extremism, recognize it for the extremism that it is, and see that there can be an Egyptian Spring, there can be a Madison Spring. I don't
mm-hmm.
know. Am I just trying to be? Am I?
No,
drafting?
No. I mean, we have to live. It is happening. I mean, despair is really. I mean, it is. I think it's very important that to have that again, you know, the cliche, hope springs eternal, right? But, I mean,
mm-hmm.
hope is very revolutionary in that regard, right? Because,
right.
I mean, everything is also conspiring us to only see the really negative and to, so I see it happening too, but it's not over. I mean, it is an ongoing process that we have to participate in, right? There's no sideline activity
here.
Yeah,
especially now. I mean, maybe it's just the age I'm at now. You know, I mean, I don't know if I'd have said this when I was 20, but, I mean, things weren't the same when I was 20. But, I mean, it feels like more than ever, you know, just the average person sitting at home on their sofa has to get involved now. Because
I agree.
The tipping point can go either way, you know.
Get involved. We have to get together with others of like mind, and we have to publicly express.
Yeah.
What we feel and what we know to be true. Absolutely.
Well, and even sort of piggybacking on what you were talking about when we were talking about Avatar and you were trying to remember the novel, seeing things through the other person's eyes, the non-hero, that makes me think of the riots in London. I mean, not
yes.
that I'm for violence. I'm not.
Right.
But I could understand why they were in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, not that I wanted anybody to get hurt or not that I wanted anybody who lost, you know, whose property was damaged to lose anything, who were innocent. But heaven forbid, can't they see what this austerity is doing, people? You know, and it's like
absolutely.
They're oblivious. They're oblivious to it. And it's sort of like, might we not look at these kids the same way we looked at the people in Tunisia that rioted? And,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure they're the bad guys.
No. Have you read Walter Mosley's book? Do you know who Walter Mosley is?
No.
He does those E.D. Rollins
who...
mysteries.
No.
And they're detective stories, but they take place in a different decade in Los Angeles. And he really, through this detective story, tells a great deal of social history from another point of view. And one, Little Scarlet, tells the story of the Watts riots around that time and sort of
mm-hmm.
the hippies in Haight-Ashbury. And we see it from the point of view of, like, how those riots really were, you know, expressions of deep frustration that demanded change in racist
right.
American culture. And I thought of the other book. It's Wicked.
Okay.
By Gregory Maguire, that retells the story of the Wizard of Oz from the point of view of the Wicked Witch.
Oh, so you're talking
Elphaba,
about the Broadway show. The Broadway
show. Yeah, but
show
it's a novel
Wicked.
First.
Okay.
It's a novel first by Gregory Maguire. It's a fabulous, brilliant philosophical novel as well as a great read, and completely revisions the story of Oz.
Wow.
And I do think that's part of our work of activism. You know, I think we just, it is going to be a transformation, and it is a transformation of consciousness. And yes, that's been going on throughout our lifetimes, and it is continuing, and every energy we can put toward it. And one strategy of that is to take that other point of view and then compose the narrative around it and get others to join into telling the story that way.
Well, you know, my mother used to call that putting the shoe on the other foot.
Yep. and then taking a big step, right?
Right, taking a big step together, because you know you can empathize with this person you thought was your enemy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the last question I think I'll ask you, because I don't want to keep you too late, but I mean, because obviously I could talk to you for a very long time.
Likewise, me too. I wish I lived in California.
Well,
I mean, California just has so much more going on. But anyway, go ahead.
Well,
Karen.
And I bemoan the fact that I'm down here in Southern California, and it seems like all the, you know, the really fun conversations are going on in Northern California.
I don't know. Southern California sounds pretty good, too.
Okay, so you, one of the other things I wanted to ask you about is you see nuclear power as a form of female power, and you say, isn't nuclear power apocalyptic? So talk about that a little bit. Is this go into that chaos thing again, too?
Yeah. And again, you know, I've had a lot of really good teachers, women and some men that I've learned a great deal from. And one of them was Paula Gunn-Allen, who, do you know who Paula Gunn-Allen is?
I'm sorry, I don't.
She died a few years ago. She wrote a book called The Sacred Hoop, Recovering the Feminine in American Indian Traditions.
Okay.
And she originally grew up, her mother was from Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico. And Paula is one of those ones who, you know, you were never the same after talking to her, because she always took the opposite point of view or made you see something through another way. And it was she who taught me that nuclear power, like, you know, is invented in New Mexico, right, in Los Alamos.
Mm-hmm.
But that really those cosmic forces of creation and destruction are female.
Hmm.
You know, that
well, yeah,
that,
I think of Sekhmet, you know.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
You know, some of the Egyptian goddesses, they're
exactly.
Destroyer
Sekhmet,
goddesses, but they're
absolutely.
Also mother goddesses, yeah.
They are, and they, you know, that, you know, again, to get away from this splitting that took place in patriarchal consciousness and culture, you can't really separate creation and destruction. You can't really, because of course death happens, right? Everyone, we will all die, and something new will come out of that, and that is the basic movement of life.
So maybe part of the fear of woman or the fear of goddess was fear of that duality.
Yeah.
Maybe we could shut off that idea. I mean, does that make any sense?
It does. I think it all really, you know, there. I think ultimately it's about fear of death, and that's why older women, and I think we're both heading in that direction, well, we're all heading in that direction, right? But that's why older women are so taboo, so scorned, so feared, so maligned, because they make everybody think of death. You know, the mother is the one who gives you birth, the maiden is the one who's, you know, the juice. But the crone is the aspect of the sacred feminine that they most cannot face, and it is terrible fear of death. And you know, the machine is so idolized in this culture because the machine seems that will never die, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
There's this kind of immortality, you know, again, this immutability of the God, the eternal God, not the transformative deity, right, who
mm-hmm.
undergoes process.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think so. Nuclearism, in a way, comes out of patriarchal culture. This is what my book, Gossips, Gorgons, and Crones, is about. It's about the ultimate desire to dominate nature and to split, penetrate, and control the ultimate source of life, right? That sort of creative cosmic power that's contained within the atom.
Because ultimately we're all just afraid to die, and if we can control it, then maybe
right.
we don't die.
Well, that's what they think, but actually they just create megadeth, right? I mean, it's complete folly.
Yeah.
And inventing what they did when they invented the nuclear weapon, they thought they were showing their absolute control over nature, but what instead they did is show that they have absolutely no control whatsoever, right?
Well, you know, and what I'm thinking too, Jane, and, you know, again, you know, maybe I'm just blathering, but, you know, if we had not gotten away from nature, if we could have just expanded our understanding of nature, then
and seen ourselves as part of nature.
Yes. And then, and if we would have not been afraid of death, but realized that we were maybe just going to turn into energy that was going to be recirculated and come back another time, then maybe it wouldn't have been so scary and all of this wouldn't have been necessary.
Yeah, and I think some cultures, you know, believe that. There's still some cultures that understand that and practice that. But it's the ego. You know, it's like that me, ego, right? This,
yeah.
Again, when you separate from the whole and see yourself as this isolated individual, which is sort of the essence, at least, of Western masculinity.
Instead of me with the Porsche and the big bank account that I can't take with me,
yeah.
You know, you don't value, you know, those sort of external things are too important. And so you don't want this life to die. You don't even want to transition into something else.
No.
Does that make any sense?
Yes, I think it's just this kind of ego of, you know, that separate, isolated ego that cannot feel like the real nature of reality, which is that we are intimately connected with everyone else and that everything they do affects us, everything we do affects them, and, you know, that we are a whole in some ways. We've lost sight of the wholeness of who and what we are.
Yeah, I recently I've been studying Kabbalah, and what they teach in Kabbalah, I'm really surprised at how closely it aligns with goddess ideals, quite frankly. It's been really intriguing, at least the way they teach it at the Kabbalah Center here in Los Angeles. But one of the things they teach is our interconnection. In fact, they talk about if you don't share and if you don't, you know, if you don't see that, if you try to create division between people rather than, you know, coming together, it actually creates disease. And I'm saying disease and dis-ease both together,
yes.
You know. And I'm imagining what a world would be like if everybody thought that if we didn't share, if we didn't connect with one another, if we didn't communicate, that it could be the death of us. I mean,
we're seeing that happening, aren't we?
but we don't, you know, but we don't comprehend it quite that way, do we, you know?
Mm-mm.
You know, we just don't, I don't know, I guess we're not looking at the big picture. I don't know how to verbalize it.
No, we're not. We're seeing, no, you're verbalizing it exactly. I mean, it's that kind of isolated individualism again that is, I do think it's related to gender in that it's that, again, we must separate from the mother, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the man particularly must separate from the mother in order to be a man, in order to be an adult, in order to grow. Whereas, you know, in another tradition, engaged Buddhism, Thich Nhat Hanh says, you know, there's always that cord connecting us to the mother. We can't live without it, right? If we really separate from the earth, we can't live at all.
Well,
but
and
there's
the
this fantasy
say,
of escape, of separation, that and the association of that with maturity, when actually it's folly.
Right, right. Well, and to piggyback on that, the Kabbalists say that women are more evolved spiritually, that it's the men who have to mostly do the work. And if the men don't bring the sacred feminine into themselves, they don't have much hope of having a successful, happy, fulfilled life. You know, and I'm thinking, oh, gee, why can't these sorts of ideas just sort of take hold the world over, you know? I'd like to, like, have an intervention with Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin.
Yeah, I know, that's what I was thinking of. Wow, where are they at? But there is a global feminist movement and a global women's spirituality movement and a global awakening of all these kind of ideas that we're talking about.
Well, I
you know, whether
to
it's in
Wangari
Maathai's Green Belt Movement or you know, all the kind of work that Vandana Shiva does in Earth Democracy. So I do think it is happening. Like you said before, it doesn't take place overnight.
Yeah. Well, and I think because, you know, the corporate-owned media, we don't hear about it.
No,
you know?
Exactly. They're controlling the narrative, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. You know, they don't want us connected. They want us disconnected because heaven forbid if we ever got organized. Well, and also you say on the back of your book, and maybe we can close with this because, again, you know, I don't want to keep you too long, but I don't want to let you go either. You say that, alternative imagination of female power can still be found behind the cult devotion given to Princess Di. And animating all the goddesses disguised as monsters, queen bitches, mammies, vamps, cyborgs, sex bombs. Just elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I do think, again, like that desire for the female divine and a need to connect with female sacrality, you know, as much as they try and erase it from patriarchal religion, it comes through in another form, and it comes through a lot in the popular culture, the adulation given to Princess Diana or Oprah Winfrey, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is religious.
Right.
It's a religious devotion. And the kind of behaviors after Princess Diana died, those, you know, the
flowers on the lawn, remember
all
that,
over
yeah.
the place, right? I mean,
but do
the
you
way
think
that
people
she was
recognize
talked about,
that,
the kind
though?
Of, yes, but, I do. But, I think in some ways, I mean, we even talk about the sex goddess, right, in popular culture, you know,
yeah.
at the Hollywood. And, you know, we recognize that there is this...
the need for the mother.
And it isn't just the mother, it's the lover. I mean, I think one thing about... I mean, there were more lover goddesses than there ever were mother goddesses. You know, the
okay.
earth was understood as a mother, but really also as a lover. And,
yeah, because she had to join with the male so that we had the next agricultural crop. And is that what you're sort of talking about, the dying
and
rising
king
thing?
And not even just
thing?
That, but that even if she was, like, complete in herself, she was an erotic being. Not, you know, we've split the mother and the lover in our culture, too, right, which is
mm-hmm.
that good girl, bad girl kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we need the earth to be both mother, lover, and other, mystery. You know,
mm-hmm.
and never
mm-hmm.
separate those three, really, but understand that they all really work together. And because otherwise we tend to get into, like, the patriarchal understanding of mother as just some drudge who's going to clean up after us and love us and forgive us forever, as in that hideous children's book, The Giving Tree.
Right.
Or the lover would just be, you know, the bad girl or the prostitute, you know, all separated and put
mm-hmm.
into these, like, negative caricatures.
Instead
but,
of a whole woman. Instead of a whole woman.
A whole being, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the other is the mystery and the understanding, too, that there is shape-shifting and gender migrations back and forth, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That we are both female and male.
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, the powers of generation exist in both sexes, and we're more alike than we are different, and we're in this kind of flux. And
mm-hmm.
continuum all the time. So I think we need to really break, that's what I mean also by New World Chaos, outside of these categories that have imprisoned us
mm-hmm.
and really get rid of some of those categories and understand much more fluidity
yeah,
in our identities.
Yeah, give ourselves permission yeah, to rethink everything.
Absolutely.
Really good.
So yeah, I see like whether in all, like Alice Walker has this great essay on how in the racist caricature of the mammy, really, we're seeing the all-abundant, loving, nurturing mother figure, you know?
Well, she was the powerful one. I mean, you know, you think about even Gone with the Wind. You know, I think, you know, the mammy, you know, she was sort of ruling the roost, you know?
She was, but she wasn't. She was enslaved. But she was enslaved.
Yeah,
but she was
correct.
The one who had the knowledge and the powers to nurture.
Right.
But she
right,
was
right.
enslaved. And
yeah.
she was abused, and she was, you know, derided. But, you know, she still is the one with the power. Yeah? I mean, you know, in a mythic sense, right? Obviously not the enslaved women, although,
well,
you know,
I guess I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking about how, I can't even think, the girl, the main character, the I Will Never Be Hungry Again. What's her,
right.
you know?
Scarlet.
Scarlet. You know, I'm thinking how much she sort of, I mean, they were, the mammy, unless I'm remembering it wrong, because I haven't seen it in a long time, but, you know, she was like a mother figure for her, you know?
She was, but again, like enslaved. And
an enslaved mother.
And made herself... They made her sexless, and they made her jolly as if she enjoyed being a slave. So all of that is completely wrong.
Yeah, just stereotype.
And then the white women are the ones who the story is all about and who get to exploit the energies of these figures. But again, if you turn, you know, if you turn the story on its head, you realize it's not really, you know, the silly white woman with the 16-inch waist. And I don't mean all white women are silly or anything like that. But the ones who are at the center of the story, when actually it's the background figure. Often what's happened is that, like, in patriarchal culture, what's put into the foreground is the oppressive figure. And if we look at the background, we have much more of an idea of what's really going on, who's really got the power. Again, because so many of the truths and the alternative narrative has been suppressed and put into the background.
Have you
but
ever
Mary
taught
Daly
a film
is the
class?
One who said, bring the background up.
Bring the background. Have you ever taught a film class?
Yeah, I teach classes. I teach a class called Sex, Violence, Hollywood. I teach a class called Women, Myth, Power, and
okay.
Film. And we do a lot of these movies, and we really talk about alternative ways of, you know, of reading them and looking at them and seeing, you know, because when you rework the story and you retell it in a different way, you know, you're restoring truth and history in some ways.
So your the two films that you made, did you want to talk about them a little bit?
Yeah, the pornography, well, one I've only made one so far. The Pornography of Everyday Life tells the story of contemporary advertising, you know, how women are being treated in popular culture and how these images of domination are so normative. But also what I was talking about earlier about how basically why it's so important to put women down either overtly or more subtly is because all of this is a continuation of patriarchy's war against the sacred feminine. So all these put downs of women over and over and over, stripping of women, you know, making our sexuality into something either for sale or something dirty or something, it's all a continued derogation of the goddess from ancient times when the goddess was first called the whore. Did you know at this Rick Perry event, you know, that big revival he had,
mm-hmm.
they were quoting some of the preachers who were there, and one of them said, Oprah Winfrey is a harlot in the service of the whore of Babylon.
And she's the harbinger of the Antichrist.
And that the harlot for the whore of Babylon. So you can see here how, you know, they're talking about the priestess of the goddess, right? But
turn
it
they
to the harlot
also,
of the whore.
Well, and they were also saying that the Japanese, that the stock market crashed in Japan because the emperor was cavorting with a demon. Of course, they were talking about Amaterasu. They were talking about Lady Libertas was a demon.
Right.
They were talking about wanting to rename the District of Columbia to District of Christ. These people are nuts.
Right. And see, but all of this is a continuation of the war against the goddess. And that in order for the patriarchal god to be credible, goddess had to be demonized and turned into pornography. And she has that didn't just take place in the past. It's happening constantly.
Yeah.
And so that's what the first film is about.
Well, it's a shame that you know this stuff hadn't come up. You could have included that in there. Maybe you'll have a part two.
Oh, there is going to be a part two. That's what I'm working on now.
So,
right. That would be perfect to put in, even like how late the Statue of Liberty is a pagan goddess.
And people don't realize.
But she is a pagan goddess.
Well, yeah, and so what, you know?
I know, which is a good thing. That's just it. They can't get rid of the goddess. They can't.
And they don't realize how much of their own religion was based on paganism. You know,
Stealing and distorting it. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Well, if anyone wanted to see that documentary, Jane, is it possible? I mean, how do they see it?
Well, it's distributed from Berkeley Media. Many university libraries have it. And I also, I guess my contract with Berkeley Media, it's been out for more than 3 years, so I'm allowed to sell it myself. So anybody can find me on Facebook and ask me about purchasing the film, and I do a sliding scale.
Okay, very cool. And now you said you have another one coming up, Green Consciousness.
I'm not sure what I'm going to call it yet, but it's basically about this need, you know, this greenness, and this would be another whole show, but greenness is associated, obviously, with the environmental movement, but it's also identified with the sacred female, like the green goddess, and Isis is green, and green Tara, and the greenness in nature, and is really in many ways a metaphysical principle as well, greenness. And so I explore all the meanings of greenness. And again, we see this greenness in Shrek and Princess Fiona and Poison Ivy, right? Who really is sort of the earth goddess, right?
Mm-hmm.
Again,
mm-hmm.
demonized in some ways, made into a villain. So green consciousness is really all these kinds of values and consciousness that we've been talking about tonight, basically in recognizing our connectedness, in restoring to sacred dimension, you know, the mother, lover, other, earth, right? So that the film is going to be about that. But how I build these films is I again, go back to that point I was making before about how we're surrounded by all these advertising and other kinds of images that are constantly telling a story to us, but often one we're unaware of, or we, you know, it just becomes part of the background, but not in Mary Daly's sense, but just sort of reality, even though we're not aware that it's constructing our reality. So what I do in here is I show a lot of images and deconstruct them, sort of like what we were talking about tonight, and compose an alternative narrative about what's really going on.
You know, I really wish you would do an online class for people like me who can't come to your class. Have you ever thought about doing something like that?
Yeah. It's just, as a teacher, I rely so much on presence.
Yeah.
And creating a chemistry and a bond among the students who are sitting there.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
But on the other hand, we need to reach out beyond just those who are physically present, right?
Yeah, because, I mean, like, I teach classes, too, and people have said, well, you know, why don't you take these classes online, for the very same reason I'm saying it to you. And, you know, there's something about not having the feedback that it just sort of falls flat. And it's, you know, I lose energy teaching a class over the Internet because you don't have the feedback.
You're absolutely
from the students,
right.
You know, you don't have that give and take, you know.
No, I know, because it can be ecstasy. To be in a classroom where everybody is tuning in and the energy is flowing. I mean, I do find teaching ecstatic. I'm sure you do, too.
Well, I do, and I worry
that
a lot of the really good teachers, they're aging now. Is there anybody taking their place to carry on this information?
Definitely.
You know,
there is?
Yeah, there are?
I see them all the time, yeah. Yeah,
okay.
We have amazing students in our women's studies, our master's program. But I like the idea of going online. And, you know, I mean, I do think you're right, because how else are we going to connect with others? You know, we are in the midst of a kind of diaspora of, like, you know, we aren't all in one community where we can physically gather. So we need to gather in other ways. And even with Skype or some kinds of ways, maybe there would be ways to have more presence, at least what we can get. Think how much presence you can get over the telephone. Maybe we're going to be able to make the internet work.
Well, and I don't know enough about technology, but maybe there's a way, you know, because if there were maybe a little bit of money behind it, maybe if a college got behind it or something and had some money, maybe there would be a way to have more of an interactive class. But anyway, I just think about that because, you know, just my little show here, you know, I get people from the middle of Red State, wherever, calling me and say, Karen, you don't know what the show means to me because
I can't talk
about this to anybody. You know, I feel alone, but you're a lifeline. Imagine if she could tap into you, you know, and get this, you know, well, of course she can get your books, but, you know, just, you know, it's just different, you know, when you actually are connected to a human being. But, well, I guess, Jane.
All right, that gives me great food for thought, Karen. Thank you. I'll think about how that could take place.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll talk to each other more about that.
Okay. Well, I guess as we close, because I know I've kept you longer than I promised, are there any movies you think listeners should maybe go out and rent, any come to the top of your head that, you know, might be a really good one for them to sort of deconstruct?
Oh, God, you can deconstruct almost all of them. Let me think. Nothing is coming to mind right now. I would recommend that everybody read Wicked. By Gregory Maguire. He's so brilliant in taking the point of view of the Wicked Witch. And, again, what I'll do is I'll think of a list of movies that I recommend everybody to see.
All right, we'll put it on Facebook or something.
It on Facebook, because often when somebody says, remember a movie, I don't think of it until 5 minutes later. I always want it, like, good ones to really, you know, as you say, deconstruct. Not necessarily to inspire you, but inspire, you know, you get energy from, like, seeing through it. You know?
Yes. And you wonder if the writer and the producer even knew what they put on paper, you know, or they're just sort of an aspect of the culture, and you know, they don't even really understand what they presented. Does that mm-hmm. make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think Shrek is one of my favorite movies for that. Mostly the first one, a little bit the third or the last one, where Princess Fiona becomes a warrior. But Shrek is amazing about greenness. You know, have you seen Shrek?
You know, I honestly didn't, because I thought, oh, what a kiddie movie.
Oh,
know?
No, no. It's brilliant.
Okay.
It was written by, the story was written by William Steig, who was really making it an anti-fascist narrative. Farquaad,
mm-hmm.
for those of you who have seen it, lives in this, like, totally artificial city. Everything has to be clean and tidy and ordered and monitored and mechanized, and everybody has to pretend to be completely happy. It's a total fascist ideal. And he kicks all the fairy tale beings out who represent queerness, oddness, feminine, you know, all the kind of values that we ascribe to, right? Everything that
mm-hmm.
doesn't fit into that horribly fascist order.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the story. Princess Fiona is the goddess, and she has two sides, two natures. I mean, but in a not in an opposite way, but in the way that nature works, night and day, summer, winter. It's
mm-hmm.
And it's really ultimately about loving the natural self.
Hmm. Okay,
so
well, I'm going to have to rent it now.
Brilliant movie. Yeah,
okay.
I think.
And
yeah.
Did you have any thoughts about the popular series Xena?
Oh, I love Xena. Yeah.
Okay, so do you think that was a better portrayal, even though they had her, you know, it was even though the violence that was attached to it?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes women have to be warriors too, right?
Sure.
In certain situations, and
okay.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Buffy, Xena, they were all really they came out of feminism, and.
Okay.
That's where popular culture, again, our stories will be told. And often, even if the stories themselves, as the media tells them, isn't perfect, what the viewers do is they take them and they reshape them and they retell
mm-hmm.
them. And right now I'm sort of gaga over this Game of Thrones, which is...
Oh, yes. Isn't it wonderful?
You love Game of Thrones, too. Yeah.
Oh, God, I love it.
Yeah.
So good.
Okay. So we take, you know, often this is where alternative philosophies are spun in these fantasies and, you know, not in the elite halls of academia.
Right.
But
right,
often
right.
in these popular culture narratives that play on these themes of power. And I mean, I think the psychical realities that he talks about in the Game of Thrones of shape-shifting and green
mm-hmm.
dreams are amazing.
Well, and I'm really curious what they're going to do with the girl with the dragons.
Oh.
Have
you read the
books
or just seen the series?
Well, I didn't read the books. I was just watching the series on television.
Yeah.
I'm probably missing a lot not reading the books.
With the girl woman, she's about 16 at the time or something, emerging from the fire with the dragons.
Yes,
what an image
yes.
of goddess, huh?
Yes, yes. It was just incredible.
And that ancient
just,
connection between woman and reptile or serpent or dragon.
I was like salivating, you know.
Me too. Okay, me too. Completely blown away. So see, there's the image of the goddess in popular culture. Totally.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, and I guess I'm thinking that, you know, a lot of this, you know, we've sort of, you know, popular culture has rehabilitated witch. You know, now they have to rehabilitate feminist. You know,
yeah, that's a good idea. Yeah.
You know,
I like
because I still think, you know, feminist is still getting beat up a lot, you know,
oh,
by the
totally,
Rush Limbaughs
totally,
of the world,
totally.
You know.
Ugh.
So, well, I guess as a final thought, Jane, and because I've enjoyed this immensely, and I thank you so much for your time. I know you've said a lot, but is there any parting thoughts or that we haven't said that you think is important for listeners?
No, nothing.
We covered a lot.
We covered a lot. And like I said, if I think of anything else, I'll give you a message and let you know. But I think, all right, I'll tell you what came to me, and I kind of said it. I go a lot through my dreams. Do you all pay attention to your dreams?
When I remember them. I just don't remember them.
Of believe in the green dreams. And one time in a green dream, that's from Game of Thrones, the novels. A little leprechaun appeared to me and said, I said, what do we need to do now? And he said, gather and vote. And I think we've talked about that a little bit tonight. We need to gather with others
mm-hmm.
of our, you know, who want
mm-hmm.
what we want.
Mm-hmm.
We have to desire it. We have to gather. And we have to, like, the word vote means really literally vote, but it's also from the devotion, right?
We have to
publicly express our devotion. Yeah, that's what vote, like votive candles and votaries and devotion.
Okay.
But vote is like a public or a full affirmation of your beliefs, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think we need to gather and vote. And that came to me in this from a messenger in a dream, and I'll just put that out there then as what we need to do. I think
well,
we were doing
we...
some of that tonight, and I hope to continue.
Well, I wish we had an eco-feminist party to vote for, but until we have something else, at least we can try to stave off the Paul Ryan plan.
I agree. Or the Michelle Bachmann one.
Oh, God, yeah. Okay. Well,
all right,
Jane,
thanks so much, Karen.
It's been wonderful. Thank you for staying up late, and have a wonderful
thanks.
Day. And I can't wait to read your books. Do you mind if I email you about them as I read them?
No, I'd love it if you did. And I'll send you a copy of the film, too, The Pornography
of Everyday
Life.
Okay, thank you so much, Jane. You're wonderful.
Okay, Karen,
thank
great
you.
Talking to you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. And, wow, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Jane Caputi as much as I did. Wow, that's all I can say. She shared so much of her many years of research and scholarship about patriarchal domination, especially as it affects women. And I got to tell you, I can't wait to read her book. The one that talks about all the movies is Goddesses and Monsters. As I said, I don't think I'll ever look at the movies that she mentions in this book the same again. So, let's see. We are coming to the end of the show, and I promised if you stayed with me, I was going to read to you this little thing that came across the internet called Evolution of the GOP, 100 Things You Can Say to Irritate Republicans. And I'm trying to see where you can get a copy of it. I can't really find it right now. It doesn't say on here. I think somebody just emailed this to me. But if you're really interested, email me and I'll go to the trouble of finding it. But anyway, it comes from, I think, Addicting Info is the name of the group who might have put this out. Addicting Info is the name of the group. And they say this time they came up with 100 things you can say to irritate Republicans. Here are a few. But they have links that actually go to each of them when you go to the website. So anyway, I digress. So here are the 100 things that you can say to irritate a Republican, and it's called the Evolution of the GOP. Number one, you can tell them that a socialist wrote the Pledge of Allegiance, that Jesus healed the sick and helped the poor for free, that the founding fathers were liberals, that fascism is a right-wing trait, that Reagan raised taxes 11 times as president, that Reagan legalized abortion as governor of California, that Nixon created the EPA, that Ronald Reagan supported gun control, that hate is not a Christian virtue, that Republicans spend more money than Democrats, the Constitution is law, not the Bible, Sharia law doesn't exist in America. The president is not a Muslim. Corporations are not people. Fox News isn't real news. It's just racist, sexist, hateful, right-wing propaganda. The Federal Reserve was a Republican idea. Women are equal citizens who deserve equal rights. Abortion is a relevant medical procedure. Just ask Rick Santorum. Please use spell check. I'm not sure why they said that. It's pundit, not pundit. Social Security is solvent through 2038. Roe v. Wade was a bipartisan ruling made by a conservative-leaning Supreme Court. Barack Obama ordered the killing of Osama bin Laden, and it took him 2.5 years to do it, and Bush couldn't do it in 8. 9/11 happened on George Bush's watch, therefore he did not keep America safe. Separation of church and state is in the Constitution. It's called the First Amendment. Muslims are protected by the Constitution just as much as Christians. America is a nation of immigrants. Therefore, we are all anchor babies. Got that? The white race isn't disappearing. It's evolving. Evolution is real. The earth is 4.54 billion years old, not 6,000. The founding fathers did not free the slaves. Hear that, Michelle Bachmann? Ha ha ha. The revolution was not fought over slavery. Paul Revere warned the Americans, not the British, here that's Sarah Palin, federal law trumps state law. The Civil War was about slavery, not states' rights. So for all of you trying to rewrite the history books in Texas, that's one especially for you. Corporations care more about profits than they do people, that's for sure. Getting out of a recession requires government spending. Don't we learn anything from history, FDR versus Hoover? Glenn Beck is a nut job. Republicans don't want to pay for your birth control, but they want to pay for their Republicans don't want to pay for your birth control, but they want you to pay for their Viagra. Republicans need Viagra. Fox News is owned by an Australian and has a Saudi prince as an investor, actually one of the big investors. I think he owns just under 50%. Republicans complain about immigrants taking American jobs and freely give American jobs to foreigners overseas. It's called outsourcing. Labor unions built this country, and you better thank them for your vacation, for your minimum wage, for your pension, for your holidays, for your 40-day work week, and on and on and on. Republicans only care about children before they're born. Churches should stay out of politics or be taxed. The current corporate tax rate is the lowest in 60 years, so stop whining about it being too high. Republicans say teachers are union thugs, then proceed to rape and mug the entire middle class on behalf of corporations. 99, think rape isn't a crime. Republicans think rape isn't a crime, but miscarriage is. And number 100, bottom line, if you want to anger a conservative, tell them the truth. Anyway, I just really like that. I hope you enjoyed it too. It gets really frustrating seeing what's going on out there and the total disconnect from reality. I mean, I'm sure you feel it too. You can't even have a reasonable conversation, and it makes you wonder how this is all going to end. Anyway, as we come to a close here tonight, let's close on a positive note. You know, in honor of Jane Caputi and women like her, whose scholarship has made us so aware, let me read the mission statement of the radio show. As many of you know, adversaries of the sacred feminine tried to sweep away awareness and knowledge of her for all time. And with that sweeping away, when the great she was made to disappear because of the religion of patriarchy, of selfish and disconnected men and their war gods, women and their power, their leadership, their spiritual authority were thwarted, repressed, became taboo, diminished, and disrespected. That's why here on the show I am dedicated to recovering the great she, whether she be deity, archetype, or ideal. Yes, we intend to defy, to taste the forbidden fruit, to be powerful and uppity women, to throw off the shackles, look under every rock, behind every locked door, peer into the abyss of the past, so we know why things are the way they are, how they have come to be so turned on their head and so unnatural, and we are going about setting things right. Why? Because if we want to save ourselves as a species, if we have no other choice, if we want to restore balance, harmony, wholeness, sanity, it's women, armed with our like-minded brothers, armed with the ideas of the sacred feminine, who will set things back on course. Yes, transformation, yes, activism, yes, we have to be spiritual warriors. So let me once again repeat the mottos for the show. All truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it is accepted for being self-evident. That's from German philosopher Arthur Schopenhauer. And from Gandhi, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. I think we've been going through these phases as the sacred feminine is being reborn. And you know what? We are going to win. So, listeners, I want to thank you for tuning in. And I want to share with you this closing prayer to end tonight's show. But before I do that, I want to remind you, we spoke about this in a previous podcast, I want to remind you to make sure every day you take a creation break. And by that I mean, you know, instead of a coffee break, instead of a cigarette break, instead of a chocolate cake or, I don't know, Hershey's candy bar break, you take a creation break. Because when we are grateful, when we live in a state of appreciation, it is easier for us to be armed against the outside world, against fear, against, you know, those negative feelings that creep in now and again and make us wonder, is it all going to be okay? You know, it's almost like an antidote to fear, you know, because when we remind ourselves of the good things we really do have, it doesn't really seem as bad as we think it is out there sometimes. So take a creation break. You are creating your own reality. That's why we call it that. It's or a gratitude break, if you want to call it a gratitude break. I don't care what you call it. Just take every day a moment and say, I am grateful for the money that I have. I am grateful for the love in my life. I am grateful for my cat who sits on my lap and purrs. I'm grateful for the beautiful flowers that grow outside my window. I'm grateful for my health. I'm grateful for my mother or my wonderful husband. Whatever it is you are grateful for, you know, maybe you got to sit down and make a list one day. Maybe you really got to think about it because it's been so long since you really thought about these things. Do whatever you have to do, but do it. Do it for you, you know, because you know what happens? This is almost like magic. This is a manifestation tool. This will help you bring into your life more of the things you are grateful for. Yeah, maybe you don't have enough money, but if you're grateful for the money that you do have, more will come to you. It's better than focusing on your bills, because you know what? If you focus on the bills, you're focusing on scarcity. So instead, focus on abundance. Focus on the sustenance, focus on the prosperity that you do have, because it can always be much, much worse. So when you focus on the things you have, more of it will come, whether it be health or business or clients or creativity. You know, just be grateful for the things that make your life good, and more will come. And just thank Goddess for all of those things that she's provided, because she's there for you. She is always there for you. Maybe you can just say you're grateful for being able to acknowledge Goddess without being burned on a stake, that you are free to worship in the way that you see fit. So in closing, I'm going to read this prayer to you from the Goddess Temple of Orange County, where sometimes I minister or teach or just visit. They send me a prayer every month. And this month goes like this. I don't know if you can hear the music outside the window, but it sounds like a musical parade is passing by. I hope you can hear it. It just will add background to the prayer. And it goes like this. Great Mother in all, all life continues in all ways. New beings are birthed constantly in miraculous forms with the power of motherhood, the power that lives inside me always as a female. I am able to create, birth, and nurture that which I choose. What a blessing. Thank you, Mother. Blessed be. Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in with me tonight. And next Wednesday, I am going to have Joe Carson on the show. And Joe Carson is a documentary maker. She actually made the feature film Dancing with Gaia. And that work ties into Farifaria, which is what the topic is actually going to be for the show. And let's see, Farifaria, how did she describe it to me? It's about the mysteries of nature religion. I promise it'll be very interesting. I've spoken to Joe before, and I think you'll enjoy hearing about, you know, Farifaria. So thank you for being with me tonight and every week. I want to thank those of you who have sent in contributions because, you know, it is not free for me to do the show anymore. I actually have to pay for it every month. So if you can spare a few dollars to send my way, it is most appreciated because, you know, a lot of people send in a few dollars. It all adds up. You know, you don't have to send a lot. So I think that will bring the show to a close, and I'm going to let you listen to something beautiful as we close out the show. Since we have a little bit of extra time, more than usual, I'm going to pick something that sometimes you don't get to hear because, you know, we run out of time here. I'm looking for this by Lane Redmond. I'm sure most of you know her, the wonderful drummer Lane Redmond. She's allowed me to use some of her music here on the show, and I'm going to let you hear Invoking Aphrodite. That's Invoking Aphrodite by Lane Redmond. So, again, thank you, listeners. I never can say that enough because you are gas in my tank. You keep me going. I appreciate your feedback, and you know, I'm glad you're out there listening. Good night.
Leave Crete. Come here. Come to the holy place. Come to the sacred grove. Your altars are smoking with incense. Cold water sings through the fruited trees. Everything is shaded under the bower of roses. And from the shimmering radiance of leaves, an enchanted sleep drops down. Here is a meadow of spring flowers where horses graze, and a soft wind gently breathe. Come, Aphrodite, pour your nectar into our golden cup. In grace, make the libation. Bring your Melissa to life.
ogni poco tu sei a talento, gli limiti a te sì.